I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Yes, that signifies another sit around a table and have a conversation kind of episode of Film Sack. That's right. This is Film Sack, a discussion episode with me, Scott Johnson. We got over there one Brian Dunaway, one Brian Ibbett, and one Randy Jordan. Hi, Brandy Jordan.
Brandy.
Just one day ago, you were a year younger. It's good to have you in the future.
I know. Yeah, well, everyone is older right now than they were a minute ago. So.
Oh, my gosh. Don't remind me.
If they might be gens, taught us nothing. They at least taught us that.
That's true. They taught
us. Every picture of you is a picture of you when you were younger.
Yeah, that's true.
But the good news,
the good news for the home. Yeah, exactly. The good news for home listeners is that none of you had to do any homework. There's no film this week. We finished all of our Sacktobers. We are taking a break from that. And because a very, very busy weekend happened, we thought perfect time for a little sit down and discuss. So we're going to do that. And what we're going to talk about today is interesting. It's going to be about directors and their sometimes lopsided efforts. In other words, I'll give you an example that nobody put in the list. So I assume no one's going to bring them up. We may talk about them anyway. But Soderbergh. Anyway,
sure.
That guy makes Oceans. He makes a lot of great movies. He makes Oceans 11. People love it. It's an amazing heist movie. Redefines the genre. People are stoked. 12.
Not so much.
A bummer. Back to form in 13, but still, you know, 12 is a real bummer. That's a good example of it. And we want to figure out why. Why do these auteur directors, these people that we, you know, even us individually may glom onto super hardcore and go, man, that guy can do no wrong until they do some wrong, you know?
Mm-hmm. And so I want to stop you right there.
Go.
I want to stop you right there because I kind of have choked on this question a little bit while thinking about this. And so I just want to ask the Bryans, what is an auteur to you? Like what? When I say, hey, we're going to talk about auteur directors, what the hell does that mean?
To me, right. It's go ahead, Brian. See, this is why it's Brian and I are...
Right. Fight!
Look at that. Fight. Like, okay. Oh, no, after you. Oh, no, sir, after you.
Round one.
All right, I'll do it. Look, yeah, okay, so auteur is usually when I think of it in the way that we apply it, it's a young director who's blazing some new ground, right? A unique look into what... directing and that particular flavor and taste that they deliver. That's what I think of when I think of auteur.
Okay.
I don't necessarily break it down as by age. I say someone who has just achieved master in their craft of directing. Are they a sponsor, by the way? Oh, that's Masterclass. Right. Anyway, like someone like Spielberg can still be considered an auteur, in my opinion, because he's established himself. He's a pioneer necessarily a pioneer, but an easily agreed upon master in the field.
Okay.
And that's why I'd say auteur
It seems to me like there's a third element there, and it's an important one, and that is that we associate the final work with an individual and not like a team or a committee. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, I could see that. I mean,
we could say auteur, We point at someone like, and I don't know why Alexander Payne is on my mind. He's been on my mind. I'll tell you why. It's because I walked in to the living room and my wife was watching Downsizing. But we point at an Alexander Payne movie and we say, that's an Alexander Payne movie, mm-hmm. you know, whereas there might be, I don't know, some random Marvel movie where you don't even begin to associate it with a person. Because no. you know, like, no. there's right. so many people involved in what you
Too
end up
many
seeing.
People.
Really. Yeah, a lot yeah. of people. Right. You also may even know the directors. You might go, oh, I like the Russo brothers because I thought that Winter Soldier was awesome. So I'm glad to hear right. they're doing new Endgame
Kenneth
and
Branagh,
Infinity War.
Or, yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So you have those moments, but also in those scenarios, you know that they're a smaller piece of the movie pie when they're directing Marvel or Disney or Star Wars yeah. or any of that stuff. Right.
When they direct, they are walking down a very narrow hallway that doesn't necessarily give them a lot of freedom to move around. But they're still the one pushing that cart down the hallway. But they can't push it in any direction.
With
but
the
forward.
Money. Yeah. When the money gets big enough, rarely can one person shoulder the burden.
Yeah, even though you want them to, right? You hear that Rian Johnson's right. going to direct a Star Wars movie, and you're like, dude, the guy made Brick. He made that other cool one I forgot the name of. He's like a really great auteur, young director with great ideas. And then he makes Star Wars, and you kind of go, had his name not been on there, take away all the controversies about the most recent trilogy for a minute. But sure. if his name had not been on there, you wouldn't go, well, that's clearly got the fingerprint of the auteur yeah. Rian Johnson yeah. all over it.
Well, exactly. And yeah.
Before we go any further, I just want to say there are some really successful, really famous directors who we would never call auteurs because they are like, they're kind of like pinch hitters. They come into a project and they competently direct a thing, but they don't impart their style on it.
Right.
Maybe they don't even have a style. And I'm thinking of people like Ron Howard.
No, Ron Howard's a great example. We just watched half of Solo for TMS Couch Party, and it was this a reminder that it's not a Ron Howard movie in the sense that it's a Ron Howard movie. It's just Ron Howard stepped in, actually halfway through production anyway, and took over for Lord and Hoo-Ha, who left.
Lord and Hoo-Ha.
And that's kind of a weird thing to do. You go from, you bring in a top Hollywood director who's known for, you know, big, giant, critical success hits, best picture stuff, best actor stuff. And then he swoops in and says, yeah, I'll work on your weird, you know, Han Solo prequel.
He's such a student of film that I think that, he's able to mimic. If he could just come in and do his thing. I kind of feel like Sam Raimi is a very competent director that has his, you know, a very specific style. But when he did Spider-Man, I mean, he was just like, the first time he did it, it was like, he stayed very much within the lines, but then the second time he's like, let me take it out for a spin.
Then for the most recent Doctor Strange, he said, you guys all step aside. I'm taking the reins on this horse.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that because I think those are the best parts of that movie. That movie, when he gets to do what he wants to do, I mean, yes, it takes it away from a happy-go-lucky Marvel film into kind of a darker take like he's known for, but at least it feels like I'm getting. His auteur-ness is sticking out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm. And it's sticking out.
So I want to assert, and I could be totally wrong here, but I'll bet you that there's a huge percentage of people who like movies and go to see movies and they know their favorite stuff.
Yeah.
Who, if you went to them and said, hey, what's the name of the director who directed Witness and Dead Poets Society and The Truman Show and Master and Commander? They could not name him.
No.
And it's just,
I can't, but they can't.
Yeah,
Peter Weir's one of my favorite directors of all time, and it's a bummer that people don't. But he's more like a fully cooked turkey dinner as opposed to somebody who's just really good at hot dogs or something. And by that I just mean, you know, if Peter Weir's involved, it's going to be big, thick, epic, respected, amazing. But there is nothing about
his. You're not going to see a popcorn flick with Peter Weir.
Exactly. But you're also not going to see, you know, it's not going to be like Tarantino. Where his style is really obvious. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, Peter Weir isn't writing the film and isn't editing the film and so on and so on. That's just, that's all we're trying to say.
Yeah, if anything, his job is to kind of make it all better than it was going to be in the first place. That's what he does good. Mm-hmm. He comes in and says, Truman Show, check it out. Look what I can do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which sounds like a dumb thing on paper, totally worked on screen. That guy is a genius. Love him.
Yeah.
But Randy's point about, you know, to go see a style, it's because, you know, you see the trailer and you're just like, oh, yeah, I want to go see that movie, but not actually attaching a director to it. And I always say his name wrong. So correct me, please. Denis Villeneuve, however you say his stupid name.
Denis Villeneuve.
I think it's Denis Villeneuve.
It probably is. That's not the point. The point is, if you see a trailer for Arrival or Dune or Blade Runner 2049, any of those kind of movies, you're going to have a very particular flavor. You're not necessarily going to attach it to that director unless you're like us who love directors. But, you know, if this is the general public, you would definitely go see it for the feeling or the mood of it.
Sure. Mm-hmm. But then even though I have kind of that relationship with Peter Weir films, you tell me he's making something new, I get really excited. He also made The Mosquito Coast, which I think is kind of terrible. That's not a good movie.
No.
That came out in 86, not the TV one that was recent, but The Mosquito Coast.
Right, Harrison Ford. Mosquito Coast.
I didn't think that was very good.
I saw it then, and I was expecting something more Harrison Ford-y, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, because we'd gotten some Indiana Jones, we'd of course gotten Han Solo and stuff like that, and I thought, all right, cool, more Harrison Ford. Oh, this is not the Harrison Ford I want. And I think that might have soured me on the whole experience.
So there's a downside to being an auteur, and that is, if you're an auteur, people can point at your worst movie and say that's all your fault. Whereas with Peter Weir here, you might say, you know what, I'll bet the studio screwed somebody on that or something, right? Mm-hmm. That was a terrible script. No one could have saved it.
That's a fair point. We tend to blame other things when stuff doesn't work, and instead of the director. What was that? We all saw that Michael Douglas Ridley Scott movie. What was that called? We saw it recently-ish, the last year. It was
the one with Demi Moore. Ridley Scott.
It was a cop, and he.
Oh, Hard Rain.
Black Rain.
Oh, Black Rain.
Chocolate Rain. I think it was Black Rain, right?
It was Black Rain.
Hard Rain was We Just Want the Money. That was a different
thing.
That movie is could be anybody made it. It really is not a. It's not a Ridley Scott joint, like in by any stretch. In my opinion, somebody may disagree with me, but I don't think it has any of his hallmarks, his signatures, his tone. I mean, maybe some of the cinematography is nice and dark and whatever, and maybe there's some blue hues or whatever stuff you're used to from him. But it's not a very good movie. But nobody is ever going to go, well, that's it. Sorry, Mr. Scott, you're done. You made this poopy piece, so I can't take you seriously anymore.
Poopy piece.
Like, because you know he's got more in him. He's going to make something else that's rad.
Right.
And he'll stumble here and there. And even when he stumbles, freaking Kingdom of Heaven, theatrical, terrible, terrible movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not good at all. One of the worst things he ever did. He goes home, does his own director's cut, runs about 4 hours, puts it out on Blu-ray. Blew my effing mind. It was so good. Such a good movie. It was like I was in two different dimensions with those two films.
Yeah.
So
I don't want to insist on this, but like a part of the rubric here is Ridley Scott has no writing credits. Ridley Scott is not a writer. Right. And there's a thing there where when the director is also the person who came up with the whole damn thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like you just have a lot of opportunity for it to be really great. And also a lot of opportunity for it to really stink. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but we don't remember those who just made one stinker and went on with their lives. Right.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
I forgot about the critic till you said it stinks.
It stinks.
He did like a student era film in 1965 called Boy and Bicycle. It was a short, and that is his only. It's his only writing credit. In other cases, Alien Covenant is listed as well. Let's see, as well as the new Alien TV show that's coming out as conceived by. But you're right; he only ever wrote like a student film, and never anything again. But I mean, you can't see good. That's interesting because I still think of Ridley Scott as like one of the all-time greats ever. Mm-hmm. Would it? Does it matter if he wrote any of it? I mean, I don't know. Maybe those writers didn't get enough credit.
And maybe he doesn't have a passion for writing. Maybe he can write and he just chooses to not really do it. I mean, you know.
Maybe he's got his own little notebook at home with a bunch of rad stories in it that he doesn't share with anybody.
Yeah, little rad stories. It's like, maybe he doesn't like to write at all. He's like, I don't like putting stuff on paper. I'm not down with that.
Yeah.
Give me a camera.
I'm Ridley Scott.
Like, just like kind of like trying to push the baby out the birth canal. I just want to point out.
What do we any of us know about that?
Yeah,
I just want to point out George Miller has a lot of writing credits on his movie.
Oh, yeah. My goodness. Yeah, so he's a good example of all the writing. However, I will be the first to admit George Miller, who I revere. For anyone at home who doesn't know, creator of Mad Max, certainly Fury Road is his crowning achievement. We'll see if he can do it again with next year's Furiosa, assuming it all comes out at the right time. He's made some bummers, and he wrote some bummers. Like the bummer. Go ahead.
Yeah, I've already forgotten where you land on 3,000 Years of Longing.
Okay. So this is going to sound weird, and I'll admit it's a little weird. I have not seen it yet. And the reason I haven't watched it yet, you'd think as a rabid fan, I'd be all up in it. And in theory, I am. I'm afraid to watch it. And the reason I'm afraid to watch it is I don't want to be. I mean, I didn't even pay attention to the reviews. I don't know where it landed critically. I don't know. I don't dare go in there because I don't want a happy feet to this business. I don't want to find out it's bad.
And then, I totally understand that. And I think a lot of like filmophiles are the same. Like, you freaking love Christopher Nolan and you've heard, you know, Tenet is coming out and there are some mixed reviews. Like, it was hard. People were dragged to see Tenet like months after it came out. Right.
Yeah. Tenet was weird.
I haven't seen it.
You should.
I still enjoy Tenet. I still wouldn't say it's Nolan's worst.
What do you think is his worst? I think it is his worst, but what do you...
You do, really? I know this is probably going to be controversial. I liked Insomnia a lot less than I liked Tenet.
Oh, interesting.
Interesting.
That is controversial. It's important to say here, though, we're talking about... This is like the worst of his work is still better than many people's best work. So I liked Tenet, but if I'm making a list... You're putting a tenant below
Insomnia.
It felt a little throwaway. Maybe it was, you know, you can't take the pandemic out of that equation. It was hard to, with everything going around it and them trying to force it in the theaters and it wasn't working and they had to figure out what to do and he was fighting the studios and all that stuff. It's hard to separate those things. And to me, the controversy seeped into it. But if you look at his best work, in my opinion, it's things like Interstellar,
Dark Knight,
freaking, what's the one that I love?
The Prestige.
I love The Prestige. Memento's amazing. I really liked Insomnia.
Might be my favorite of his, personal favorite.
What's the one with, Inception. Inception. I love Inception so much. Like, and all his historical stuff is great. Like, he's an amazing film.
Oppenheimer, of course, is fantastic.
Yeah, I still got to
say. Yeah, it's funny. On IMDb, just the star rating, we've talked about, you know, how much you can trust ratings, things like that. Tenet has a 7.3, while Insomnia has a 7.2.
Okay. Right around where you're at with it, then. It sounds like you're with the people, Brian. You're a man of the people.
Well, I don't know. I mean, those are so close. And again, only people who are going to be passionate about it are going to care enough to rate. And so it's not everybody who's seen Insomnia, go rate Insomnia. It's people who are passionate one way or the other, go rate Insomnia.
Yeah. My thing with Miller, though, is it's interesting. I don't actually count Happy Feet, even though many people think it's his worst film. Sure. And he did direct it. Happy Feet 1 is a delightful film. It won Animated Film of the Year that year. It's a fine movie. Yeah,
it's just a different flavor than people are used to.
Well, I think if you could say the same thing with The Straight Story, David Lynch. You know, it is by far the most non-David Lynchian thing.
That's true.
That he's released.
I love that.
It's far better than Happy Feet, but but still, it's like it was way out of that Twin Peaks, Mulholland Drive.
It's more like Babe, you know?
Yeah.
It's like his version of Babe. Although people think Miller wrote Babe 1. He didn't direct it. He directed Babe Pig in the City. And that one is less reviewed well.
It's like, oh, now you choose to get involved.
But then you forget you forget this dude. He's only directed 19 movies. You forget he did like Lorenzo's Oil, the Sarandon.
Just Sarandon and
Nick Nolte, right? I think. Witches of Eastwick was his. You know, there's that one segment, The Nightmare at 20,000 Feet with John Lithgow and the Twilight Zone movie. He did that was really cool. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's a little bit of a mix in there. So in my opinion, where he stumbles before he goes to such great heights again is actually Beyond Thunderdome. And the reason I think that is the potential is so wasted there on where we were going with Road Warrior. Thunderdome on paper sounds amazing. A giant Thunderdome to fight in. A guy, a little tiny guy giant, on top of a huge guy asking who runs Bartertown. Like, these are amazing concepts, right? Just amazing, cool new looks at this wasteland movie zone. And instead, they try to make it a little too mainstream. They hire a pop singer who I like. I like Tina Turner. It's not a problem. Yeah. But I just, and then they put that music in there. It doesn't match, doesn't fit. No. Like, to me, it's a huge mistake.
For a thing that needs to look dry, dusty, gross, beat up, ruined, it was just a little too glossy in parts.
Yeah.
And I think the Thunderdome, the actual Thunderdome aspect, the actual dome itself, I think is a great concept. And I think easily not the weakest part of the film, but it's the whole kids interaction, getting the kids who've been surviving, getting them to freedom. It's just basically, all right, what's the formula of Road Warrior? We have to take this thing and get it across the desert for safety.
Yeah,
and
they inserted Lord of the Flies in there, right? They made a Lord of the Flies mini movie and jammed it inside of a Mad Max film, and I don't think it worked.
works with mothers, doesn't quite work with kids.
I want to argue with you on this because, you know, I'm the Rotten Tomatoes guy. And so, like, I think Brian Ibbett hit it on the head with Christopher Nolan. If you look at him on Rotten Tomatoes, Tenet is by far his lowest.
Oh, is it really? Okay.
69% is
where Tenet is. What's Insomnia?
92% for Insomnia.
Really? Wow.
He's got a cluster of seven movies at the top of the Rotten Tomatoes tomatometer. And it's like Memento, Dark Knight, Oppenheimer, Dunkirk, Insomnia, Inception, Dark Knight Rises are all way up there, right? Mm-hmm. So like 69% is going to feel bad, but that's still a pretty good score, you know, for Tenet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Whereas George Miller is not what you would expect on Rotten Tomatoes at all. Mm-hmm. George Miller's 69, he's got two movies down below 70. And that's The Witches of Eastwick and Babe, Pig in the City.
Yeah.
And I mean, do you even, I'm not counting anything that's animated. Do you like, do you want to even count Babe, Pig in the City? Like, it's a, I don't know.
I like Babe, Pig in the City personally, but I also know that that's considered the lesser of the two movies. And also he just had this weird, like, I'm going to make kids movies for a decade moment. Right. Which fine. It's great. Whatever. I think Babe in particular is a very poetic, interesting thing. And it's not just pure, hey, here's a kid's movie with talking animals in it. There's more to it than that. But, so, you know,
like, George Miller's made fewer movies than Christopher Nolan. And so he has five that I would say are at the top of Rotten Tomatoes. Hmm. And those five are Babe, Mad Max Fury Road, and then Lorenzo's Oil, Mad Max 2, and Mad Max 1. Seriously, because Mad Max 1 was 89%. And when Mad Max 2 came out, critics managed to get it up to 93% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah. Yeah. Road Warrior's awesome. The first one is experimental and weird and doesn't quite reach the heights. Two made way more sense as far as where this thing was going. And then Fury Road is the masterpiece. It's true. All of that coming together. In fact, I kind of think you need to have a shitty time. Road? You need to have a shitty time with Thunderdome so that you can propel yourself into the stratosphere with what Fury Road would be. Like, nobody thought that was going to work. Everybody's like, whatever, kind of a soft reboot. And who's in this and what's the deal? Ends up being one of the most cinematically challenging, interesting things ever made. And I don't know how he tops himself. I'm genuinely terrified about the Furiosa movie because I'm worried about that attempt to recapture it and you can't quite pull it off. And I'm nervous. So next year, you guys are going to have to hold my hand. Yeah.
I just want to insert disclaimer. Once again, Rotten Tomatoes is highly imperfect. Like, if you're doing this kind of thing, just looking at Rotten Tomatoes, you're going to have a bad time. You're going to have Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome at 81% on Rotten Tomatoes, which is a bit high. And then you're going to have Interstellar at 73% on Rotten Tomatoes. And it's hard to believe, you know? So like,
you definitely can't. That right there is proof that Rotten Tomatoes gets it wrong sometimes.
Yeah, they don't always get it right. And sometimes you're talking about archival stuff that is pulled from old newspapers and whatever of the time, because the movie, there was no Rotten Tomatoes in 1980, whatever. Yeah. And so I don't ever know quite what to do with those ratings. I feel like they're less, well, first of all, it's like 8 critics, you know, and they're all major newspapers around the country. Whereas today it's those same newspapers plus 200 billion websites are all reviewing. So it's just skewed differently now. Mm-hmm. But
there's also the effect of time. Like, reviews get frozen in time. And when Interstellar first came out, there were some critics that didn't like it, and it grew in prestige over the following like 5 years. Mm-hmm. Like, we weren't talking about it in 2015, like the one of the best 50 movies of all time. And now we absolutely talk about it like that because it grew. People saw it and liked it so much.
Oh, that's a great topic for future roundtable, by the way.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah. Yes. Like, right place, right time when a movie goes to streaming has created this weird effect that movies that would probably have just died.
And yeah. And they tank at the box office. Usually the pattern is they tank and everyone's like, oh, shoot, well, we're never going to see a sequel to that or whatever. And then on video or otherwise just like becomes viral almost, or cult classics or whatever. Those would be fun stuff to talk about. I'd like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. For
sure.
There's plenty of those too, absolutely. Right? Tons of that stuff out there. Like,
Super Green.
Yeah.
So you prepped me for this question, and I just have to ask, Brian Dunaway, mm-hmm. What is Steven Spielberg to you in this discussion?
Oh, yeah.
Who is he and what does he mean to you?
Yeah, what does he mean to you, buddy? Is he? So Steven Spielberg is one of my first looks and going, oh, I didn't realize directors were so important. So he was the first director I recognized as being a director in my life. And I was pretty young when this happened. I saw Jaws very early on. Then I moved on to, Raiders and Saw. I didn't see Close Encounters until later, but I saw E.T. the Extraterrestrial, and I was like, what is this thing that is speaking to me so clearly that I feel like I want more? And so I sought out more Stephen King things. At the time, there wasn't a lot to watch because, you know, what was there like? That movie, TV movie, Duel.
Oh, Stephen. You mean Steven Spielberg. You said Stephen King. You don't mean King. You mean
Spielberg. Did I say Stephen King?
You did.
Apologies. The two Stevens who are very influential, because one of my favorite writers is Stephen King. Apologies, you're right. It is. Yeah. You know, Stephen King is a director, bad idea. Steven Spielberg is a director, great idea.
Sure.
Great idea.
Sure.
So, let's flip it to the other side when Steven Spielberg makes stinkers. Now, listening to Scott made me realize, oh, I think the real problem is, of course, and I've recognized this before, is my expectations. When a director goes along for a certain amount of time and then they decide, well, I want to explore, because they're human. They want to do something outside of what may have brought them success. In the case of, like Babe, we just talked about. Well, Steven Spielberg, in my opinion, when he decided to get more into the, at the time, more modern sci-fi stuff like artificial intelligence, and then he moved on to Minority Report, I did not feel like that was things. I didn't feel like those were indicative of what Spielberg had taught me was important in movies, because he was exploring a lot of things.
Well, would you say it wasn't important, you mean just this was a genre you weren't used to from him? Because he did a lot of science fiction before this, like E.T.
He did, but not like these. These were serious. I like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. That's a science fiction movie, but it mostly deals with the individuals. When he started focusing on the technologies and kind of got away from the individuals, I was like, I'm not as interested in what you're delivering here.
I think it was still kind of in the individuals zone. It's just that movie, it's very dystopic, that movie. That movie's like, well, it's Philip K. Dick, first of all. That guy writes nothing but dystopic everything. But but it's also just like, it's not your usual, same with AI. It's not your usual Spielberg, this is going to end with some inspiring thoughts kind of movie. Right. As opposed to E.T. or as opposed to Close Encounters, these movies had endings anyway, or crescendos that were like positive humanist takes. Whereas these are a little bit darker. It's like, well, we're going to swap your eyes out. We're going to make you weird.
There was far too much. I felt like Steven Spielberg was looking through the eyes of Kubrick, who he had been working with, and I did not care for it. I like Kubrick as Kubrick, but I do not like Spielberg as Kubrick. I don't like that. Do you, it doesn't work for me.
Do you? What did you think of? So speaking of Spielberg out of his usual element, what how were you about like Saving Private Ryan or Schindler's List, that kind of thing?
Oh, I loved all that stuff. All that stuff was still within the Spielberg, even though it didn't deal necessarily with the stuff that I love, which is whenever he deals with how kids are growing up and trying, you know, being independent and these really complex, really not complex kid characters. Yeah, I enjoyed that because once again, it felt more like I was exploring the human thing. Whereas like AI, it went on for decades. You know, it went on for more than decades. It went on that the endings of AI went on forever and ever. And I was like, I just can't. Yeah. I don't feel grounded. I don't feel grounded in it.
See, I don't know why I'm so opposite of you. And maybe anybody could have made it. This isn't even a Spielberg thing for me. It's that, and maybe that's your point too.
I like those kind of stories. I actually like those kind of stories. We talked about Prometheus and all these other things that Ridley Scott does. And I love all of that kind of story. I just didn't like Steven Spielberg doing it for some reason. It didn't fit in. Now, once again, I don't think necessarily a bad thing, but I don't think a lot of people go, oh, Minority Report, that's definitely my favorite Steven Spielberg film. I don't think anybody does that.
It's up there. It's up there for me.
Four of us, but it's up there.
It's up there like in the, I don't know, I'd put it in the top 10 probably.
Would you put it above The Color Purple? Yeah, you forgot he did that, didn't you?
No, I remember that. Color Purple is amazing. Color Purple is like the first thing he did that was like a
If I start naming like the 50 or 60 so films that Spielberg did, you're going to find that Minority Report slides down pretty quick.
So, I want to play a quick impromptu game with you guys. So I'm looking at his bottom three rated films. And so I'm going to start with Scott, and Scott's going to try to name the bottom three. And if you make a mistake, we're going to go to Brian Ibbett.
Okay.
Because I pulled up his list. Are you talking about the ones where he's a director
only,
right?
As a director.
Not producer.
Correct.
Yeah. He writes too. He's a writer. He is. Character writing.
Here and there. All right. So I'm going to say so
bottom three. Bottom make a guess.
So I'm guessing at the bottom three, like all three. Okay.
Yes. Just one movie. Name a movie that's in his bottom three.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and say that Crystal Skull better be there.
It is not.
What?
Oh, really?
How is that freaking possible? Okay, that's fine. Move on to Ibbett. Ibbett, you choose.
Both Dial of Destiny and Crystal Skull have a strange thing where they come out and they get middling reviews and then just kind of stick there. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're talking about reviews like on Rotten Tomatoes that are below 40% for these bottom three.
Okay. Wow. All right, Dono, or Ibbett, your turn. What do you think?
No, skip, like you said, skip me, because when we started talking about Spielberg, I pulled up his Rotten Tomatoes and then sorted by the tomato meter and then looked for the lowest, the ones called, the ones where he's credited as director.
All right, Dunaway, it's on you then, buddy. What do you got?
That's probably, I never cared for this movie either. It was the one with Richard Dreyfuss, The Always, and I only know this because I went back through the thing yesterday. So Always wasn't a big one for me.
Probably with John Goodman.
I liked Always. Yeah. It was nice.
Yeah, director and producer of that
one. It's fine. It's not great.
Yeah, not terribly reviewed, though. It's at 67% on Rotten.
Yeah, Always reminded me, like, it was like almost like a leftover episode of Amazing Stories that they just never used. I don't know.
Oh,
yeah.
God, his Amazing Stories run.
More stuff. Yeah, I love that stuff. Yes. All right, so now you lose, too. So let's come back to me and see if I can get another one. I'll go with what's the VR one? Ready Player One, is that in the bottom three?
Oh
no, sir. And in fact, Ready Player One is, I would call, overrated. It's at 72%. It came out at a perfect time, man. Everybody had read that book and were very excited, and it stuck the landing. I love that movie.
All right.
I'm going to give you a hint. We're going to Dunaway again. I'm going to give you a hint that his bottom three are two comedies and an action movie.
Okay. Comedy would be, I forgot he did 1941.
That is correct. Bottom three.
First theatrical movie, man. That's a bummer.
Yeah.
Boy, aren't you glad he didn't give up then? He didn't see his horrible success with that. Yeah. You know what? I'm not going to.
That was post Jaws, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, post Jaws and Close Encounters.
Oh, I thought it was pre Jaws. My bad.
No.
79.
Okay. Yeah. So close.
The reason why I remember that is because I made a talking point of making sure that he really started getting higher budgets and he started really doing some really interesting things after Jaws. They started trusting him. Okay.
Okay.
And it was also the great example of if anyone ever says Robert Zemeckis can do no wrong, you point him right at 1941 because that's he wrote that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. So you got
interesting movie. Belushi.
So wait, that means you get to keep guessing if you got it right. So keep guessing.
Yeah,
you got,
oh, do
you
I?
You got Hook. There's two more.
Okay. Yeah. So we had a comedy. No, what would you say both?
No, he got 1949.
Oh, Hook on there? All right. Hook was my next guess. That's my least favorite.
We talked about this when we sacked Hook, right?
I hate Hook.
Yeah, it's just.
I like Hook.
I know you do. It's not a good movie, though. It's bad.
Oh, I didn't say it was a good movie.
It's his lowest rated film as a director for reasons. I'm not sure that we really uncovered the reasons. Like it's really more of a mishmash of problems, right? Than these individual things. So you could understand somebody loving that movie because it has some great elements.
Oh yeah. There are some 90s kids out there like grew up kind of as very young children then who adore that movie. And I don't ever want to take that away from you people. It's how I feel
about
it.
But I would easily put Crystal Skull below Hook as far as my personal.
Oh, absolutely.
Ratings.
I would see Hook again before I watched Crystal Skull.
It is wild how high Crystal Skull is on the overall list. It's because he's made a lot of movies. Yeah. And, you know, like so there are movies below Crystal Skull on the list where you're like, how? Mm-hmm. How is this? Mm-hmm. Like, what mm-hmm. were they thinking at the time? Amistad is below Crystal Skull, right? Like,
Is it really? Amistad's better than that. Like, a lot.
The Terminal is below Crystal Skull.
And the Terminal's, I like the Terminal a lot.
I know. The Terminal's great.
Are both of those above Minority Report? That's what I thought. Okay.
Nope.
Minority Report is at the beginning of what I think of as his top on the list. Like as you go upward, you hit Minority Report, and then it's like Duel, Lincoln, Jurassic Park, Bridge of Spies, West Side Story. It's just like the Fablemans, and it just keeps going and going and going. You know.
So you said Hook. What was the other one? 1941. Okay, I'm going to make a... Can I make a guess?
Yes, please. Let's name this action movie and get this over.
Is it the second... I forgot the name of it. The second Jurassic Park?
Yes.
That's it? That's the one?
The Lost World?
Lost World.
Oh, interesting. See, I liked that better than Hook.
Which, again, I was going to say, I'd put that higher. I'd put it above some of the other things that that scored higher Rotten Tomatoes was.
It's got problems, but the kind of problems it have, because I think the 1993 Jurassic Park is the definition of a perfect movie. There are very few like it, and when they are, often Spielberg's sitting right there with a smile on his face. He knows how to make them. I think that first Jurassic Park is literally one of my, anyway, I don't want to speak for everyone, one of my perfect films. And that's how I feel about Fury Road. To go in to try to do a sequel is so dangerous when you have a perfect film just right behind you. And that's why I'm worried about the Furiosa movie. Because you just did a perfect film. What are you going to do now?
Let me tell you, you guys didn't mention his worst directing job. In my opinion. Even though it rates pretty good.
Spielberg's worst directing?
Yeah, absolutely not a question. You watch some of the footage, you watch the movie, you'll see what I mean. It's Steven Spielberg's director's chair video game with Jennifer Aniston, Quentin Tarantino, Penn and Teller. Yeah.
What is
I've never even heard of this. What is a video game where you direct a movie as Steven Spielberg?
Right, you make the choices, right? I just posted in the Discord server. But yeah, this very 90s, and you get to make choices. So he's made a video game. And you get to choose different scenes and which way they go and how you want Quentin Tarantino to play, because he's playing as someone who is going to the electric chair, and Jennifer Aniston is his girlfriend trying to get him out of it. And Penn and Teller are the guys who set him up.
Why is Jennifer Aniston Quentin Tarantino? Oh my gosh, Barry Corbin? What is this?
Yes, I've never
it
even
is
heard
amazing.
Of this.
We're gonna
why
talk
would
about
you have Quentin Tarantino as an actor in this? I mean, I know he's acted, but why would you have him be an actor in this game? Like,
well, he's 2 years.
He's
so
the
this
first
is,
thing you see.
This is 2 years after Pulp Fiction. I don't. So where is he professionally? Yeah. Maybe he's just so stoked to be there. I don't know. I've never heard of this shit. This is weird.
No,
was it like a PC? Yeah.
We're definitely going to cover this on another podcast we do.
So it's like a multimedia game, like a.
It is. It's a make a choice. It's basically that. It's 1990. It's 1996. So we're getting big into the full motion video stuff, and you make choices as a director to end up with a good cut of a movie. You'll choose how Quentin Tarantino reacts, whether he's comical or if he's more serious. it's a really interesting, and there's actually an online version of this. Someone is trying to resurrect this thing. I'll try to find if I can find a link on that. Kind of give you a flavor taste of what the game is like.
Fascinating, dude. That's crazy to me. All right.
What is that rate on Rotten Tomatoes, Randy?
We should check that shit out.
I don't. I have no idea.
I don't even think it shows up. Yeah.
Doesn't exist, Brian.
Absolutely wild. Yeah. Well,
I would appreciate a moment to talk about Alexander Payne.
Because do it.
This all comes from the fact where we're like, we're this entire episode comes from the fact that there's an Alexander Payne movie coming out on Friday.
What is it called?
The Holdovers.
Oh, The Holdovers. Right.
Okay. Yeah.
Giamatti.
Yes. His favorite person to put in the movie.
Well, tell me he's bringing MC Gainey back to put his wiener on the window. Tell me that's that happening.
How did I know that was coming up?
What choice did you have?
Sorry, go ahead. Can tell us more about this.
I'm sorry to say I don't think MC Gainey is in this movie. I don't know anyone else in the movie. Their names are Kerry Preston, Brady Heppner, Divine Joy Randolph. But Alexander Payne is my best example of a current working auteur, because he goes and he writes these movies. He directs them. He has a very particular style. He's clearly involved in the casting and the editing and the sound design and so on. Like he's really all over the movies. And what happens when someone is really good as that is you get a movie like Sideways, and Sideways is spectacular. Like, and it's very simple, right? You just point a camera at people and I hope you have a good script, and it does. It's such a good script.
Do you guys have a favorite? Is that your favorite then of his, Alexander Payne movies? Just curious.
Yes, Sideways. Okay. Sideways is my favorite.
I have a special spot for Nebraska. Yeah, Nebraska and I get along real well.
I haven't seen Nebraska yet, but it's been on my list of why haven't I watched this yet.
Yeah, Team Gibbet here. That movie is still to this. Oh, man, I kind of want to watch it now. 2013.
So
anyway.
So Alexander Payne also made some stinkers. Not just Downsizing. Like, Downsizing isn't that bad. There are moments of brilliance in that movie. Mm-hmm. It's just a script that meanders and it loses you. Everybody will get lost at some point watching that movie. But he also, he made his bones writing Jurassic Park 3. He was the writer of Jurassic Park 3.
I know I'm weird, but I liked 3.
He was tapped to write I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry, which I just think is so weird. Wow. Alexander.
The one where they had to get married for insurance reasons. At Sandler and
Kevin James. His best friend. Yeah.
James. Yeah, Kevin James.
Yeah, that's right. That was all right. Where he hit his stride was 99's Election. Election was like his big, he's got something to say. Good. I really liked about Schmidt as well, but yeah.
Well, and he made a movie called The Descendants that I feel like no one has ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
And, I
love The Descendants.
It's a love letter to Hawaii, which is why I think it's so great. But it's also like just really good example of you get really great actors. You give them a good script. You point a camera at them and see if it's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It also goes in places you don't expect Descendants. Like, you think it's going to be wrapped up in this certain way, and it goes a completely different direction, and it's amazing. Takes you completely by surprise.
Can't believe that was 2011. That feels like yesterday. Weird.
Yeah, it does.
He's picky. Like, look how long he takes between movies. The Descendants 2011, Nebraska 2013, Downsizing 2017. And then this year, 2023, The Holdovers. Like, there's big chunks of time, but where that guy's just like, I don't know, sipping tea and
smart,
finding hoes. I don't know what he does. I don't know what he's that guy's up to.
He's managed to stay out of the grinder that is Hollywood, right? That's good.
Maybe. I mean, I hope so.
He's more like the slicer.
He has epic hair, which my hair would
do. Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Gosh, dang it. I wish my hair, as I get older and it gets grayer, it also gets thinner. Nope. Alexander Payne's over there with a bush of hair up there.
Right, exactly.
Good Lord. And,
he's just one of many. Like, we could do a whole second. Maybe we will. Maybe someday we'll do another, like a part two on this discussion, because we haven't even touched on Luc Besson. Like, that's a whole discussion himself.
Almost like favorite.
Yeah.
We have many times talked about M. Night Shyamalan, but he definitely belongs in a discussion about auteurs and their failures.
that's a tough one, because unlike some of the ones that we've been talking about that have a majority of their work really loved and appreciated, and one or two failures for poor M. Night Shyamalan is one or two brilliant, regarded as super super high quality.
He had a really good run for a minute.
Yeah. It's weird.
I still like most of his movies, but
do you know what I've noticed though? This is a little weird. Almost every major director we've talked about, with the exception of Payne and Ridley Scott, one common actor throughout all of this, Bruce Willis is in everybody's shit. Like,
I know he's because he's just in everybody's shit. Like, I think Bruce Willis for a time never met a script he didn't like. And
that's true, but some of these are so great, like Unbreakable, Fifth Element for Luc Besson. You got your we just talked about Rian Johnson. He was in Looper, amazing in Looper, even though Looper had problems.
He's typically been known to be real easy to work with. So I mean, how could you resist?
The rumor was he was hard to work with. That's what I always heard.
It was later on, like during when he was on Friends, apparently he was very difficult to work with.
Interesting.
Yeah. Big pain in the ass.
Although, who knows how much of that, now that we know so much more about what he was going through at the time, how much of that was him struggling with, you know, early onset Alzheimer's or dementia or whatever, that it just came across as, man, he is real stuck up, doesn't talk to anyone kind of bastard.
Yeah, that could have gotten... That could have been worse because, I mean, it's hard to say. We don't know, but that's probably true if I had to guess. You always hear about that with people prior to their actual symptoms manifesting. They get real grumpy and they get mad about the way they're feeling instead of, I don't know what else you would do. I'd be mad. Mm-hmm. I'd be pissed.
Oh, yeah. I would be too. Oh, so frustrated and mad. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's one of the things they tell you when you're dealing with somebody who has dementia. You have to be, they easily get frustrated. Because it's frustrating.
Well, yeah,
right? It's
frustrating as hell. Imagine sitting here at this meeting, you know, our little show here, and then suddenly one of us is like, "Who are you? Why am I here?" Like,
right. Imagine what we do, which is we can't remember an actor's name. Now imagine it. You can't remember the co-host name.
That
takes it to a different level.
Yeah, right? Whole different level, and it couldn't be more frustrating. And whether you like it or not, the world is set to discriminate against that kind of thing, even if they don't mean to. You become less good at being a person, or you become less good at communicating, and people push you to the side, whether you know you're doing it or not. It makes me very sad. This is a weird way to end our episode, but here we are. Here we are ending.
I know, right?
I think I can bring it around, because the overall topic of these individuals who end up being like almost solely responsible for the outcome of film can also apply to some actors. There are actors where we look back at their career and there are certain movies where we just go, that was a Bruce Willis movie. And, you know, there was a writer and a director and so on, but that was a Bruce Willis movie. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like I think that's a really interesting, again, maybe a part two, but there's this really interesting thing where you don't have to be the writer and the director to dominate what we feel we saw, you know? Mm-hmm. Whenever Mel Gibson comes up, because it's such a fraught subject with Mel Gibson, I always think of the movie Payback, because I can't really imagine that it had a director. you know, it's just like Mel Gibson he chews up every part of that movie.
Well, Mel Gibson didn't direct that himself. I thought he had directed, written it, and starred in it.
No, just the star part.
that's how it feels, you know?
Oh, that movie rocks. Yeah. We got to watch that on here.
Yeah.
I love that movie so much. All right. Well, there you go. It's a fun discussion. I think people at home are going to have some thoughts, so please send those in, filmsack@gmail.com, or you can text us your thoughts or voicemail them to 801-471-0462. Do we know what we're doing for our movie next week? I don't even know. Is it on the list?
We're going to watch Slacker.
So Slacker is still, it did not disappear in the time.
Correct.
So, okay, good.
HBO Max, Max is apparently still in an expansion season. they're in the season of expansion.
That's right.
So they're holding on to things.
This is Linklater's.
Slackers or Slacker?
Slacker.
92
right. Richard Linklater film.
Yeah. 90.
Yeah, 1991 Richard Linklater movie Slacker. Oh.
Okay. But Wikipedia claims it's 90.
Hear that, Mommy? Confirmed.
Why does this happen? Wikipedia says 90. IMDb says 91. I found another link somewhere that says 89.
It was more of an independent film, right? So it kind of got a quick, like a small release, and then maybe larger release. Like
Maybe.
What happened? Sometimes.
Well, Linklater's, it's his first real Hollywood-y movie. It's first movie, I mean. First feature film. Oh, here we
go. Yeah. April 21st, 1990 at the USA Film Festival, then worldwide release or US release, July 1991.
Gotcha. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Can you believe that, though? First film, Linklater, man. That guy's there. Talk about a director with a pretty solid list. Yeah. He's pretty great. there are some bad movies, not bad movies. There's some stuff that I'm just like, okay, whatever. But
now you've really brought it full circle. We're going to go from a discussion about auteurs into watching one of the, like, the most preeminent auteurs, like his, you know, his, what Before Midnight.
Yeah.
Before
Sunrise, the whole Sunrise Midnight trilogy or quadrilogy or whatever it is.
Boyhood was amazing.
That is just only him. Only Richard Linklater could have made the movie Boyhood.
Dazed and Confused is still, I still think Dazed and Confused is my favorite thing he ever did. I love that so much. I could watch that now. Mm. Just captures youth in a way that nobody else seemed to do it. And they did it in an era I wasn't even born in. It's crazy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Linklater, that'll be later this week. So watch Slacker, everybody, HBO Max or Max if you prefer, like they do. That'll do it for us, for me, for Brian, and for Randy.
Later.
We'll see you next time.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.